Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Good afternoon from the Space Coast, everyone, from the Florida Space Coast, that is. This is your host, Daria Ann. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Right Stream Tuesday. As always, I have a great show lined up with an excellent guest, author George Galderisi. And George and I will be getting that interview underway here in just a few minutes. But first, for those of you who don't know anything about me, I am the founder of the Right Stream Radio Network, which you can find out more about at our website, rightstreamradio.com. We are currently broadcasting 5 unique shows on the network, including Just Believe with Lisa Tarvez, Military Monday with John D. Gresham, Right Stream Tuesday with yours truly, Family Power Hour with licensed clinical psychologist Dr. Billy Eisenberg and family law attorney Sheena Benjamin Wise, and Love, Liberty, and Lip Gloss, which is a women's lifestyle show hosted by Lisa and me on Friday evenings. So please check us out at that website. You can find out more about me at my blog, dariadigiovanni.com. That's dariadigiovanni.com. I am an author, a ghostwriter, blogger, and social media marketer. And I write, among other places, I write for the American Journal. That's the-american-journal.com. And I invite all of you to please check out my latest post there, which is an interview with an author I've spoken with several times on the Right Stream show, and that is Declan Finn, most well-known, I guess, for his Pious trilogy and for codename Winterborn. I did an interview with Declan, which I just published on the site about an hour before going live today. You can check that out at American Journal. And you can follow me at Daria Ann on Rightstream. That's D-A on Rightstream. Listen to me. At Daria Ann on Twitter. That's D-A-R-I-A-A-N-N-E. But you can also follow Rightstream and stay on top of all of our shows and book reviews at Rightstream. And that's W-R-I-T-E, stream. So I'm really just really thankful for my hosts and for all the guests who take the time to come on the show. Our tagline for Right Stream is rejoicing in the flow of creativity. And what I love about this network, and certainly with my show, is the fact that we interview people in a diverse area of thought and opinion and subject matter, for that matter. Just Believe deals with the paranormal and the metaphysical, Military Monday with the wonderful John D. Gresham, who is a military historian, delves into various aspects of military history and, of course, books. And my show takes on various genres. And also, I have a focus, as you know, on independent publishing because I am an independently published author. But actually today my guest is with St. Martin's Press, and I'm really excited to bring him on. He's got an amazing career and a lot of great books to his name. And so without further ado, I want to read a little bit from George Galderisi's biography, and I invite you all at any time during the show, if you have questions for George, you can call us at 347-945-7246. That's 347-945-7246. Or if you're too shy to call in but you've got a burning question, please type it into the chat room. I will keep an eye on it, although it's challenging some days to be producer and host simultaneously, as John can attest. But I will do my very best to get your questions answered. I hope you enjoy the interview today. And let me, without further ado, tell you a little bit about our guest, George Galderisi. George is a formal naval aviator who began his writing career in 1978 with an article in U.S. Naval Institute Proceedings. His Navy career included 4 command tours and 5 years as a carrier strike group chief of staff, as well as 3 years leading the United States delegation for military-to-military talks with the Chinese Navy. He is currently the director of the Corporate Strategy Group at the Navy's C4ISR Center of Excellence in San Diego, California. He has written 9 books, including the New York Times and Publishers Weekly bestseller, Tom Clancy Presents, Act of Valor, the novelization of the Bandito Brothers Relativity Media film starring U.S. Navy SEALs. Also, the Amazon and Barnes & Noble top seller, The Kissing Sailor, which proves the identity of the two principals in Alfred Eisenstadt's famous photograph, as well as over 200 articles in professional journals and other media. We're going to focus today's interview on George's latest bestseller. It's the first of in the Tom Clancy spin-off series, Ops Center, entitled Out of the Ashes. And we are going to talk about that, but I'm hoping that we can also discuss some of his other books as well, because I know many of you probably did as well. I saw Act of Valor back in 2012, I believe, and absolutely loved it. And I'm fascinated by the process of turning a film into a novel, because it seems to me we usually see the opposite, novels turned into films. But again, without further ado, I think I've blabbed on long enough. Let me welcome our guest today, George Galderisi, to WriteStream Tuesday. George, is that you?
Yeah, Daria. First of all, thanks so much for that very kind introduction. And if my mother were alive, she would appreciate it even more than me. So thank
Aww.
You. Thank you for having us on the show to talk about books. So yeah, just glad to be here. So you teed up a lot of things. What would you like me to jump into first?
Well, you know, now George, let me ask you: is your co-author with us today? I have another caller on the line, and I to the best of my knowledge, it was just going to be you and I, which is great. But I don't want to exclude anyone. I see we have another caller here. So,
if Dick is calling in, and I'm led to believe I think Dick intended to call in. So if that's Dick, I think it'd be a twice as good an interview.
Awesome. Okay. So that was okay. Well, let's go ahead and bring this caller on. Hi, Dick. Is that you on the line?
It is I.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry for the confusion. I was under the impression that only George would be able to make it today, but I'm thrilled that you're here.
Happy to be with you.
Great. Well, okay, so let's start by giving each of you gentlemen a chance. I know, George, I read a little bit from your bio, but let's start with you. Why don't you just introduce yourselves to the listeners, and then when you're through, Dick, you know, you go ahead and do the same.
Okay, yeah, well, Daria, thanks for that. I think you did a very wonderful job just kind of recapping my career highlights. Again, 30 years on active duty, started out as a helicopter pilot and then moved into the amphibious Navy, and then last 5 years on active duty, I was with carrier strike groups as a chief of staff. So I think, like Dick, a lot of my professional military experience undergirds my writing, and it's nice to be able to write stuff that you know, as opposed to stuff that you just either make up or look up on the internet. So since you did tee up Act of Valor and mentioned you saw the movie and asked about the novelization thing, I'll start off with that primarily because it was the first project Dick and I collaborated on, and then let Dick jump in through just one of those nice chaos theory things that impacts your life. Dick was scheduled to meet with one of the directors of Act of Valor, Mouse McCoy, here in Coronado at the Hotel Del, actually, and as a good friend, he invited me to lunch. We had a nice lunch with Mouse. Given names Mike, but he insists on being called Mouse, and there's a story there we can kind of get to later if you like. But anyway, we were talking about one of Dick's books, The Sheriff of Ramadi, which their company, Bandito Brothers, was talking about optioning. And after that conversation, Mouse mentioned, he said, hey, you know, we just shot this movie. We've got it in the can. We're showing it to focus groups. You guys are both military guys. Would you like to come up and see a screening in our little studio up in Culver City, California? So Dick and I were game. Dick was in Palm Springs at the time. We converged on their tiny theater, 8-seat theater, watch the movie, and I will tell you it's the most riveting 100 minutes of film I've ever seen. I suspect a lot of your viewers saw it. And SEALs, of course, are the actors. There's no Angelina Jolie. There's no Brad Pitt. It's SEALs are the actors. The movie did fabulously well, and one thing led to another, and the Bandito Brothers, and then Relativity Media, and then the Clancy conglomerate were gracious enough to let us try our hand at the novelization. So with that as an intro, I'll turn it over to Dick.
Yeah, well, it's I don't know what to say by way of introduction other than I'm a little different than George. I became a writer early on. I only spent 5 years on active duty, destroyer, sailor, underwater demolition, and then my last real job was with SEAL Team 1, and of course that was back during the Vietnam era. Since then I spent a few years at CIA. I can't talk much about that, but it was a wonderful experience to be with those folks out at Langley. And since then I've done a few different things, but primarily I've been a writer, and matter of fact, I'm looking forward to on August 5th, my 18th book will be released. And so I've had the luxury of being a professional writer for a number of years, and certainly the operational exploits of the Navy SEALs have helped bring this along. Had there not been such good SEAL operators out there, and of course the aftermath of 9/11, then people probably would never have heard from me again. But we're still at it, and it's nice to be able to contribute.
Well, congratulations on your 18th book, Dick. That's awesome, and congratulations to you both on just your excellent careers, both in writing and in the military and public service. It's really an honor to have you both on the show. So I want to just kind of finish off because, Act of Valor was just, it was such a wonderful movie. I can't say enough about it. I love the fact that they use, real SEALs and not actors. But just from a writing perspective, I mean, how was it difficult? Well, I want to ask you kind of a twofold question. Co-authoring a book, I'm sure, has some challenges. But in addition to turning a film into a novel, were there any unique challenges in doing that with Act of Valor?
Well, I'll take a cut at that at first. Yeah, collaborations are, George and I are two different people. We write differently. We see things differently. Act of Valor is it's a one-of-a-kind thing where you see a movie once, you get a screenplay in your hand, and it was only a partial screenplay. It was, and then you have to kind of take that and write develop a novel from it. The biggest thing was in a movie you cut from, you're in off the coast of Costa Rica, and next thing you know you're off the coast of Somalia, and you can't do that in a book. You have to kind of get the reader from one place to the other, so you have to fill in a lot of the white space that the movie producers can just cut from one scene to another. You have to develop the characters, color them in, then you got to move them around to the places where they need to be to complete it. So it was a little bit of a challenge, and we had about 6 weeks to do it, so that added to the thing.
Wow.
So it was one of those serendipitous things that kind of, we weren't sure anybody was going to buy this, we weren't sure where it was going, and being involved with the Clancy Syndicate is a trip unto itself. So it was one of those one-off books. Happy with the outcome. Great movie. And kind of pretty happy with the book as well. So, but again, it was one of those one-off things. George?
Derry, I don't have much to add beyond what Dick just offered. It was, like I said, it was a one-of-a-kind experience. It's something I think we'll both treasure the experience. And again, not to put too fine a point in it, Captain Duncan Smith at the Navy Special Warfare Command, I think, captured both the movie and the book pretty accurately when he said that the nice thing about the movie and one of the objectives of starting to make the movie, which started as a documentary and then, as I'll use Dick's words, serendipitously turned into a feature film, was that it both inspired young able-bodied men who might want to become Navy SEALs to undertake that as an avocation. But what the movie also did was show how difficult that line of work, that profession, that the passion was, and deterred sort of the wannabe fellows from pursuing that who shouldn't pursue that, who would probably wash out in training. So I think it had a double benefit, and I think the SEALs saw their applications of successful candidates go up after the movie. So I think it was a nice thing for both the nation and the Special Warfare Command. So, but yeah, the book, I wouldn't bet that we'd ever do another novelization, because those things, as Dick said, come along once at a time. But the nice thing about it is, because of the success of Act of Valor, our agent, John Silversack, was able to audition us, if that's the right word, to restart this Op Center series.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a great segue, George, into talking about this Op Center series. So, I guess, Dick, let me go to you. We'll kind of tag team here. Tell us a little bit about this Op Center series.
Well, the Op Center series is, you know, we were tasked with a couple books that would... I'm still there. Are you still there?
I'm still here, yeah. Okay.
I'm okay. Can we try this again?
Okay, I can hear you now. Can you hear
okay,
me?
Okay, great. I was going to say that we were tasked, you know, on at least to do two books here, and the whole thing was to try to develop you know, a contemporary scenario that was compelling, real life, and that would pick up where the old Op Center left off, continue on with a new cast of characters. So one was to develop characters to pick up the load and go forward with the Op Center series, and the second is to find contemporary real-world scenarios that would not stretch the imagination, might be tomorrow's headlines, and develop a thriller plot around those types of things. So it was kind of interesting to do. It was a challenge and, again, a collaborative effort. So we, you know, George has things that he does very well that I don't terribly understand, and vice versa on my side of the equation. So we think we developed a couple pretty good books, one that's already out and one to come out.
Okay, and so Out of the Ashes, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was released on May 20th of this year and has become a bestseller.
Well, I hope it's becoming a bestseller, but yes, it did come out in May.
Okay.
To answer your question, it was both the Publishers Weekly and USA Today bestseller right out of the block. So our publisher, St. Martin's, seems pretty happy with how it's doing, and seems very optimistic about the series.
Fantastic. Now, gentlemen, we have a caller on the line, so I'm going to go ahead and bring this caller on. I suspect I know who it is. Like I said, I don't have the luxury of having someone screen, but let's go ahead and see who this listener is and what their question is for both of you. Welcome, caller from 203 area code. You are on Right Stream Tuesday.
Hi, guys. This is Kia. I'm calling from Connecticut. How are you?
Hello.
Hi.
Hey,
how are you, Daria? I'm calling to say that I was enjoying the interview, but unfortunately I seem to have some dead air on my computer right now, and I'm not hearing anything. So I didn't know if something had happened to you guys technically.
No, we're
I think
still
we're
here.
All still here. This is George.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, I just wanted to give you a heads up that there seemed to be some kind of a problem, but perhaps it is on my end. I did reload it a couple times. I'll try again.
All right. Well, thank you, Key. Well, what would be Blog Talk Radio without some technical glitches?
I don't know what it would be without that. But so, all right, carry on, and I'm enjoying the interview very much. Hi, George. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, likewise here. And did you have a question for either Dick or for me?
Not yet, no. So I'm going to keep listening.
All right, Kia, thanks for the call.
All right, Carry on. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks. Okay, guys, so let's talk a little bit about Out of the Ashes. George, I know that on your website you have people can listen to chapter one. But give us sort of like the brief synopsis of it to kind of let our listeners know what it's all about.
Yeah, no, sure. Happy to do that. And, yeah, I would invite folks to go to the website and listen to it because I think, like most books, we try to grab the reader in the very first chapter, and if the reader doesn't want to turn the page, then the book's not very interesting. But I think the setup for this book that Dick teed up was the first Op Center series, I think most of your readers may not know, was 12 books. It started in 1995, ended in 2005, and was hugely successful. Again, a spinoff of the Clancy Mainline books. But and one of the things that delighted Dick and I about working with St. Martin's Press is they didn't require us to stay in the swim lane of the old Op Center series. In other words, the first Op Center series had a cast of characters, they had a physical place, they had things that they did, and our challenge was to retain the readership that enjoyed that series while also reaching out importantly to new readers, to young people, to women, to others who didn't embrace that first series. So we reinvented Op Center as a new place. We came up with a new cast of characters. I think readers who've read the book, as we've read in our reviews on Amazon and elsewhere, were happy with that transition. It made sense to them. But importantly, what we're sharing in the book is being, as Mr. Clancy did with his mainline books, we're trying to be prescient and show the readers what the future of intelligence, what the future of terrorism, and what the future of military operations is going to be. And our goal is that they're happy with the book today, but they're delighted with the book 5 years from now, where they'll look back and they'll say, you know, those guys called it right. So with that as a setup, if it's okay, I think your readers or your listeners might be getting tired of the monotone, turn it over to Dick to kind of walk you through what's new and different and exciting about the plot.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, the Out of the Ashes, I think, is sort of, represents what the two of us can bring to a single book within our areas of expertise. George is a good policy guy. I think he has good vision in looking into what might play and not play, and he has a very good handle on the technical collectors and the, if you will, the weapons and options at the disposal of our military. My lane is special operations, who these guys are, what they do, and how they do it. When it gets to the kinetic aspects of what we do, I think we both believe that there are three things that are going forward going to drive our military and future engagements. One of them is going to be cyber warfare, which we don't hear much about, but it's going to be very, very important. The second thing is probably going to be our unmanned aerial vehicles. Drones are going to play an increasing role in how we engage kinetically some of our enemies and how we collect intelligence, which plays pretty heavily into Out of the Ashes. And then the third thing is special operations. Of course, for thrillers, we have to have special operators with guns going out and shooting people, but I think in reality, we're going to find an awful lot of our special operators embedded overseas with friendly allied host nations trying to improve their capabilities and to resist terrorism and insurgencies and al-Qaeda and things like that. So, again, it's a blend of what we think we do best. We're able to put it together in a book, and I think Out of the Ashes is a good book. I think we've got an even better one coming up here with the next effort.
Excellent. Now, trying to ask this from a civilian point of view, I hope my question will make sense, but in terms of fictionalizing real life and special operations, I mean, are you, And I guess this kind of goes back to Act of Valor as well. I mean, I know the situations were fictionalized in the film, but, I mean, how careful do you have to be that you're not divulging things that shouldn't be divulged? I don't know if that question makes sense, but, you know, when you say write what you know, do you ever find yourself writing more than you should be, that you're giving away in a particular plot?
I'll take that first. I don't think so. I think that the real classified stuff we don't see, and the real classified stuff is in the details of intelligence collection, how we do what we do to read other people's mail, how we go about that, and some of the cutting-edge capabilities of some of our weapon systems that we really don't have any access to. Probably our worst fear is that serendipitously we make something up that might be, something that has reality, or that our nation's enemies might take on to be good intelligence when that was never our intent. Action thrillers are still about people, who they are, what they do, and bringing the personal realities of actors to the business of techno thrillers and special operations and that type of thing. So I don't think we have to worry about we make up a lot of this stuff, and we go to Wikipedia and Google to find out the things we need to know.
Yeah, Derry, if it's okay, it's George here, just piling on. So first of all, I think Dick is having been in the military, you learn very quickly how to firewall what's classified and what's not, and not talk about those things in books. So we're both very confident that process works. The other part of the process, you mentioned in my bio, I work for the Navy's C4ISR lab in San Diego, and we get exposed to a lot of high-tech stuff. But as part of the regulations of being a government employee, whether active duty or civilian, and I had to do this when I was active duty as well, everything I write, whether it's an op-ed in a local newspaper, whether it's something for an alumni magazine, or whether it's a book, has to be cleared through the Navy and through the Department of Defense for security and policy review. So they very carefully double-check all those things to make sure that I haven't done what you teed up there. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was just curious, like I said, not being in, from a civilian standpoint, I was just curious. Now, let me ask you from a character standpoint in Out of the Ashes, are there going to be recurring characters that will be back for the next installment?
You bet.
Yeah, absolutely. We crafted our characters very carefully as characters the reader would like being with, and it's a pretty wide cast. It's we were cautious not to make it a Russian novel with scores of characters, but we bring back several of the core characters in the second book, and for future books, there's others that will pop up again.
Fantastic. So. Yeah, I feel like, as a reader, you sort of want to create an emotional attachment to your characters so that they'll want to continue reading the series. Do you find that to be true? Hello?
Yeah, I think so. And we get attached to the characters. We like them, and we've developed them. They play over in your mind. And then with each, like with the second book, we have to kind of reintroduce them because somebody's going to pick up this second book who does not know who they are. They haven't read the first book. So you kind of walk that fine line of trying to reintroduce your characters and shade them in, and that's the fun part, is building your characters. But also our editors, whereas we just love our characters and want to fully develop them, our editors there at St. Martin's, they want action, action, action. So it's constantly a trade-off between trying to deepen these characters and see them move as they should throughout a story and creating some good nonstop action for the reader.
Yeah, Barry, if it's... Go ahead.
No, please go ahead, George.
Yeah, Derry, just to go back, if it's okay, to Dick's earlier comment about the things that are going to be important to national security and military ops in the future, cyber and unmanned systems and special operations. And this is really the, I think, the nexus of life imitates art. Dick and I were well into the first draft of the first book, Out of the Ashes, and an article appeared in a professional journal by a guy who's a fellow Naval Academy graduate, a different career path than Dick or I, a surface warfare guy, who very unique naval officer, Admiral Jim Stavridis, first naval officer to be the Southcom commander, first naval officer to be the European commander, strategic commander of all Allied forces, all NATO forces in Europe. A guy named Jim Stavridis, he's just recently retired and now the dean of the Fletcher School in Massachusetts. But the reason I'm telling you this is he wrote an article in a professional journal saying precisely what Dick just said, that the future of military operations is going to be cyber and unmanned systems and special operations. So, you know, back to your earlier point, these things we know and these things are in the open literature and we're tracking them. So to write a military techno thriller that doesn't address those things wouldn't be interesting to anyone from our point of view. Does that kind of make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And, I don't want this to sound like I'm trying to get political because I'm not. I'm just curious, are you optimistic that our military will have the capabilities in real life in the future to be able to handle these new threats in the modern age?
Well, that's a pretty tough question. Wow. Of course, we're concerned with fiction and developing thrillers and plots and things like that. In the real world going forward, I'll speak to special operations. And this is not my ideas, this comes from leaders like Bill McCraven and from policy people like Linda Robinson. But I think in special operations you're going to see a lot less kinetic, a lot less of these great missions where they go off and like they got bin Laden and that type of thing, and you're going to see our special operators embedded with allies, training them to bring their security forces up to grade so that they can engage terrorism and insurgencies and things like that. I think that after we conclude mainstream operations and we have in Iraq and we'll probably soon do in Afghanistan, we're going to be a lot more judicious about how we deploy our forces. I don't think that the threat of this Islamic threat and the fundamentalist Islamic threat is going to go away. It's going to be ongoing, and that we will probably be working this issue more through allied states and their requirements than putting main forces ashore someplace else and try to create regime change and manage that regime change as we have in the past. It's going to be very tough. It's going to be very demanding, and I think it's going to be ongoing, at least as far as the special operations picture is concerned.
Yeah,
there is. George, just piling on, you're right. A conversation like this could get political very, very quickly. I will say, as former Navy guys, Dick and I probably very mindful of what the Navy can accomplish and what it can't accomplish. I will tell you there was a recent poll about 9 months ago that kind of a Pew Research thing where Americans were asked to say what service they admired the most, meaning which one was doing the most important things for the nation, and the U.S. Navy ranked dead last. So I think Dick and I look at that and as Navy guys saying, you know, the threats we see in the future, just like Dick said, we're unlikely to put a large ground army on the Eurasian landmass again, so probably augurs for a more prominent Navy and possibly Air Force presence than Army or Marine Corps necessarily.
Right. Okay. And thank you for indulging me. Again, I know that's sort of, you know, walking a fine line with a question like that. It's just that, you know, kind of look around and see what's happening in the world. And just as someone who's always respected our military and those who serve, you know, and being very aware of the threat of Islamic terrorism. I mean, I'm not surprised, Dick, to hear you say that we're going to be dealing with it for years to come. Certainly with what's going on in the Middle East right now, that's becoming, you know, patently obvious, if it wasn't obvious before. So thank you for indulging that question, because I don't like to put my guests on the spot, but it's just with everything going on, I've just been so concerned about our military capability. So thank you for that. I want to kind of shift gears a little bit, and, you know, since you're both, you know, writers, and you are with St. Martin's Press, so you are traditionally published, I wanted to ask, though, if you had an opinion on sort of the advent of new media and how that changed the publishing industry, if you think that's for the better, and, you know, just kind of get your thoughts on that and find out what – George, I know you're on Twitter, for example, and Dick, I think you are, too. But I would love to get your thoughts on whether you think new technology has been positive for the publishing industry and just what your thoughts are on that. So, George, let me start with you.
Okay, you know, thanks for that, Daria. I think neither Dick or I are writing to get rich. I think as a good friend of mine, Robert Masala, who's a professional writer who, again, has done nothing else in his life, once put it, he said, you can go to a book signing, you can sell every book in the store, you can have people carry off in glory, and if you've got a parking ticket, you've lost money. So I think we all write to share ideas, to influence people, to please people. So I think the new media, I mean, if someone can read your book for $2.99 on Kindle as opposed to buying a hardback or a softback book in a store, and that's the difference between them reading it or not reading it, then I think that's all good. So I don't keep up with the statistics too much, but I did see one random one about 2 weeks ago that said about close to 25% of books are now sold as, you know, e-books. But I think it's all – I don't see a downside to it unless you're a traditional publishing house who's not moving into e-books, which most of them seem to be doing. Dick?
Yeah, well, I'm a little different than George. George has yet to quit his daytime job. I have. I did this about 12 years ago, and I'm a full-time professional writer, and so I'm kind of constantly looking at those royalty statements, and I'm proud to say I make my living as a professional writer, and it's not an easy living, but it's my living, and it's what I do. I will say that about 60% of my sales are e-books. So the e-books are a very good way for, you know, that's how I connect. My books don't do so well when they come out in hardback, but they, especially my nonfiction books on special operations training, have long and productive shelf lives as trade paperbacks. They're sort of, I'm happy to say that I enjoy great success with the books I've written on training, because I'm the only writer that's been allowed to come and walk with special operations trainees in the Navy, the Army, and the Marine Corps. So as far as the new media things, yes, I have to put up with the Facebook and Twitter and engage in those things. And George and I, we have to have our... You know, thanks to George did it first, I finally luckily just did put up a website to where people can kind of look at my books, look at me, and find out what I'm about, what I'm doing, and where I can post things on a more formal basis than the social media. But, you know, I'd much rather be a writer today than be a publishing house today, because they got their work cut out for them. The self-publishing business and how that affects their bottom line is going to be dramatic over the next several years.
Yes, absolutely. Now, George, I see that you have a blog on your site. correct it. Yeah. And how often, I mean, do you find that effective? I mean, do you blog? How often do you blog, and how do you go about that? Do you blog on things of interest to your readers that may not have necessarily have anything to do with your book? I mean, how do you market to your readers that way?
No, well, thanks for teeing that up. Like Dick said, I think we're both fairly new to websites and social media. I think it's an important part of identifying yourself as a writer. So I first of all, I have someone who constructed and maintains my website for me. I don't have that kind of talent. I probably could do it, but I'm not very good at it. So that's number one. And I tee up blog categories. I think if you look on there's about half a dozen categories. And again, it's sort of the life imitates art. It's not just book news but it's things I think of interest to people who read these kind of books. Not to tell you too much, but the categories are, you know, book news, but they're also writing techniques. It's things I find helpful as a writer, whether it's a New York Times article or something like that I put up there to share with other writers. It's stuff about national security. It's stuff about technology. It's stuff about innovation. And again, it's more of the life imitates art, and I guess that Venn diagram intersection between what I do in a day job and my personal and professional interest and what turns up in our books.
Yeah, it's excellent. I'm actually on your blog now, George, checking it out, and I'm going to put a link for each of your sites. So let me into the chat room so that people know about it. And Dick, what is your website address?
www.dickcouch.com.
Excellent. Okay, I'm putting that into the chat room now. And you know, I have to say, I was very I was impressed that St. Martin's contacted me through our RightStreamRadio.com website about Out of the Ashes, George, too. And so that says to me that they are definitely keeping up with the times and reaching out to, you know, internet radio hosts who focus on writing and military issues, of course, on this network with John on Military Monday. So, you know, I was really pleased to see that, because this is definitely kind of, like it or not, I think it's here to stay. And of course, for someone like me, I see it as a good thing, as a way to sort of democratize the whole process of getting published, and a way to really, you know, reach out to your readers. But George, let me start with you. I want to make sure that everybody knows where they can find you, and then Dick will you know, double back to you. But George, you are on Twitter at George Galderisi, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And make sure all that information is on your site as well, georgegalderisi.com. And I think Twitter, I know a lot of people don't like Twitter, but I think it's a great way to reach out and to have sort of real-time conversations with people and find your audience and learn how to use the hashtags to kind of hone in on the audience. It can be really helpful.
No, thanks for that, Darren. You are a little broken up there. We're getting some feedback. I think part of the reason, even doing the website, is to engage readers, just like your show, if people are interested. So there's a way for people to go on the website, and they don't contact me directly, because my email address isn't on there, but they contact me via the website. And I've had, I don't know, 70 or 80 contacts that way, and quite frankly, they're very enriching. One of my earlier books was Leave No Man Behind, which was the saga of combat search and rescue, which, you know, Dick and I think would agree is one of the most important disciplines in our military. And I've had a large number of people reach out to me saying, "Yeah, I, you know, heard about your book on your website. I read your book. My uncle Tony is a guy who was a rescue crewman in Vietnam, and you told his story, and now I've told him that he's in the book, et cetera, et cetera." So it's just a way to engage. It's another way to engage readers, which you know, which I find pretty enriching.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, as for the with the e-books, both of you, you know, Dick and George, you mentioned the e-books, and they have become so important. And it's true. And it kind of, you know, being able to communicate with readers like that, I think you can sort of make it up on volume. And I agree. You know, the more people reading, that's a good thing. I personally don't like not that I don't like Kindle, but I prefer to read a book, an actual book. But I can certainly understand the value of it. And so it just means that we get to have more fun on shows like these, you know, talking about your work and really going directly to the consumer, which I think for readers, on the flip side, independent publishing is giving readers so much more variety because people aren't locked into a particular genre anymore. You know, there's a lot more room for creativity. So I think it's a win-win all the way around, but I agree with you that for publishing companies that are not adapting, I think it could be a problem. So getting back to Out of the Ashes, is there anything we haven't discussed about the book that you'd like to mention while we're still on the air? I'm sorry, I'm getting some feedback here. Are you still there, gentlemen?
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm still here. So, Derry, okay. I'll kick it off here and then turn it over to Dick. I think what we're trying to show people or we're trying to communicate to people is that, number one, the threat has changed dramatically, and the instruments of national intelligence and the military are changing with it. One of the things we put into the new ops center is it lives underneath the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the NGA, which is one of the 16 three-letter agency that's part of the Directorate of National Intelligence, and it's the one where everyone wants to work. It's the coolest place to work. It's the high-tech place to work, and so our vision for the future, which plays out in the book, is that it's not just going to be strong young men with high and tight haircuts fighting the threats of the future. To Dick's point, it's going to be the cyber world, which means, as we did in our book, and we think we're seeing a little bit in the military already, we're hiring people away from Google and eBay and Amazon to invent anticipatory intelligence algorithms to get inside the enemy's OODA loop faster than humans can do it. So I think, like I said, our goal is for people to like the book today and love the book 5 years from now, because what we're predicting will play out in the future. Dick?
Yeah, I think pretty much the same thing. And, again, I'll maybe kind of take a step aside here and say that, yes, there's a lot of fun in trying to say, okay, what's next, and who are the bad guys out there, and how do we find them, and how do we take the reader through a search and destroy mission and finally get our hands on those guys and rub their nose in the mud and give them their just desserts. You know, all that's good fun. It's also, in some ways, all the technology, in sometimes, in my opinion, shoulders aside the value of these characters, who they are, what motivates them, what makes them do what they do. In some ways, it's, you know, you read authors like Jason Matthews and Charles Cumming, who write spy stories, and they develop their characters, I mean, so deeply and so carve them in so well, because it's the personalities that carry through. And sometimes in the work we do, it's a little frustrating because the technology and the needs for action and a thriller shoulder aside the rich characters you'd like to really spend a little more time with. So there is a challenge in bringing this kind of story mainstream and sell books and answer to all the people who make demands on what our books should be. Part of it, I do mourn a little bit the loss of the characters as we have to develop these real-world technical scenarios and carry them forward in the way that they may play out 3, 4, 5, or 6 years from now.
Yeah, and so now you're working on the second book in the series, and what do you think your time frame is on that for that to be completed?
Well, Daria, we've turned in a first draft to our editor at the St. Martin's, Charlie Spicer. He's given us one round of edits. We've incorporated his thoughts into our manuscript, shipped that back to him, and I think the timeline St. Martin's is on is to publish roughly one book a year. So I think we're looking forward to the second book, which they've already named Into the Fire, the second book coming out next spring.
Excellent. And let me ask, since you brought up the editing process too, you know, and I was talking earlier a little while ago about self-publishing versus traditionally published. How does that process work, and how much freedom do you have to say, you know, I don't really, you know, you get the manuscript back, it's time for you to edit it. You know, the editor comes back. I mean, is there a give and take where you're allowed to discuss some of the changes and possibly say, no, I don't think this will work? Or tell us a little bit about that process. George, we'll start with you.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. It is a give and take, and I think Dick will echo this, but for me, I don't have as many books out there as Dick does. I've just got 9, but the edits we got from our editor at St. Martin's were the most helpful and useful. That, you know, for me, most of the things I read, I went like, yeah, okay, that makes sense, and we went ahead and did it. I will tell you, and I don't mean to be the buzzkill here to any of your readers who want to become writers, but I guess the thing, and if I refer you, and this is something I've got on my website, of all the obituaries for Tom Clancy, the one I found the most useful and most revealing was the one in the New York Times. And again, that's on my website. But at the end of the article, they quoted Clancy as saying, "This is hard work." And I think the part of the danger in, you know, the self-publishing and the fact that anybody can put a book together, stick it on Amazon or whatever, is I think there are some people who just short-circuit the whole process, and they'll put stuff out there which, quite frankly, is unreadable. So I find the association with an editor helps make my stuff better anyway. And like I said, I'm not dissing people who self-publish, but I think there are some people who self-publish who perhaps don't edit and re-edit and copy-edit and make their book as good as it could be coming out of a publishing house. Dick?
Yeah, well, I think that's the case, and I've experienced, you know, both sides of that. I get very little editing, almost no editing. I'm talking substantive changing in what I'm writing in my nonfiction work, you know, and it's an area and expertise that I have and I'm very comfortable with, but I get nothing there. I desperately need the work of a copy editor coming in behind and taking care of all my grammar and misnomers and too much passive, all the things that go into what a copy editor does, I desperately need. I think George is quite right. You know, when you get into fiction, if you're dealing with a publisher, they have a vested interest in paying you the upfront monies and then investing the money and getting the book into the market. So they have an interest that this thing moves along with a certain amount of pace and a certain amount of white space and a certain amount of action, character development, technology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I will say that whereas I think the self-publishing industry is certainly is going to start carving in more heavily into the major publishers, what has been traditionally major publishing, it's expensive. Unless you're just a super literary genius, which, boy, I'm sure not, is you're going to pay anywhere from $600 to $1,000 to have somebody copy edit your work and make it readable. And I'm not talking about the substance. I'm talking about just putting it into form so it's grammatically correct so a reader can go through that. Doesn't sound like much, but it is. And then you've got the cost associated with design and things like that. So you've got to front some money before you can get that book in print. It's nice to see a book out there with your name on it, but it's expensive if you try to go the self-published route, and you better be prepared to go that way if you want a commercial success of the book.
Oh, I agree, and I've had several conversations on this show about the importance of having a marketing budget before you even start, you know, marketing and an editing budget, you know, before you even start. So I completely agree with that. My gosh, gentlemen, I cannot believe it. We are almost out of time here. We have about a minute left, but I want to thank you both for coming on the show. And is there anything else you'd like to let our audience know before we end the interview today?
Buy our books.
That's right. And they can find them on Amazon.com, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And that's we talked about Out of the Ashes. You can find that on Amazon.com, but there's several books. You can go to George's website, georgegaldarisi.com, and Dick's website, dickcouch.com. And I'm assuming that they can find your books there as well.
Yes.
Or links to them.
Absolutely.
Excellent. All right, well, I want to thank you both again for taking the time, and thank you for indulging me in the conversation about publishing. I always love to get into that with authors that I have on the program. I think it's helpful to our listeners. So I appreciate that, and I hope to talk to you again next spring when Into the Fire is released.
Thanks so much, Sherry. We look forward to it.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too.
Take care. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everyone, that was St. Martin Press authors George Galdarisi and Dick Couch. I hope you enjoyed that interview. Please check out their work and their websites. And you know, again, for those of you listening in the archives, all this information has been recorded. So that's the great thing about Blog Talk Radio when it's working. So anyway, we are going to take a break here. I am going to sign off with a Madison Rising Star-Spangled Banner. I encourage you to please stay tuned because the right-wing riot is coming up with the Prince of White Bread, Scary Smart, and Always Right. And I will see you back here next week for Right Stream Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Thanks, everyone.
Welcome to another edition of The Right Wing Riot with your hosts, the scary smart Jamie K. Wilson.
Every morning when I get late, should I go in and report to my boss?
The mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right.
Do we think that this is going to start being as obviously stupid to everyone as it is to us?
And Griff Griffiths, who is the Prince of White Men. Let's get this riot started!
Good morning, good afternoon, fellow rioters.
Hello, how are you?
Are the co-conspirators present?
I am.
Okay. Can we get a sound check? Am I loud enough for you riot girls?
I can hear you.
Yep.
All right. Okay, so welcome back to another exciting edition. I could just repeat the audio you just heard, but I think I'll skip that. We have today Scary Smart joining us from another undisclosed location on the East Coast. And then,
yes,
of course,
here I come.
The mysterious and alluring Ms. Always Right, creeping out of her closet.
Hi, everyone.
So today we just have a cornucopia of wonderful things to make fun of, and I just don't know where to start. Does anybody have a suggestion?
Pick your favorite.
It's been such a fun day already.
Yeah, it is.
It's a good one. I mean, we've got dueling federal courts right now, which is really kind of interesting. And Scary Smart, because you know these things better than I do, correct me. One district court said, you know, the subsidies as poorly written in the 2,000 pages of garbage that passes for Obamacare, those subsidies to help people pay for the more expensive health care that was ginned up were illegal. And then very quickly, was it the D.C. District Court?
I think so, yeah.
Right, which was,
yeah,
is
so.
Oddly enough, full of Democratic appointees said, no, no, they're still legal. And they had this great line I just read, which was something like, we dare not cancel this statute out of fear for what it'll do for the millions of people trying to get desperately needed health care. And apparently that's acceptable legal reasoning for the constitutional scholar-in-chief and all of his supporters. Of course,
well, too big
my
to
first...
fail. Too big to fail is a new law, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. My first thought was, golly, let me just reword that a little bit. We dare not cancel this anti-abortion statute out of fear that millions of children will die in the womb, end quote. Would that be acceptable to the constitutional scholar-in-chief and his supporters? What do you think, Scary Smart?
I think they're just a bunch of idiots. What else can I say?
That's
the role of the court. That's not the role of the court. The court's role is to look at the law, not worry about anything else, and say this is constitutional or this is not constitutional. That's it. Nothing else. And they don't do that anymore. So.
Which is
probably why
not.
I didn't go to law school. Yeah.
Well, you would be in jail now, I think.
Probably.
Defending yourself for the people when you ran amok and started battering them with the Constitution, saying this is what it says.
Well, the Constitution has been proven unconstitutional numerous times by now, so there is no point in trying to use that.
Wow. Okay, an unaccountable dose of bitterness from Ms. Always Right.
It's just an observation. It's not a bit.
Oh, okay. All right. As long as it's not you speaking, but you're merely observing what's happening in the world.
Of course.
Anything else you want to add, Ms. Scary Smart?
Always Right just said is a terrific story seed.
Hmm.
I would love to read that story.
It's a prompt.
Mm-hmm.
Are you writing that down, Ms. Always Right?
I've kept it in the bag of my memory.
Oh, excellent. Well, lest we become too downtrodden, let's think about better things. Let's think about happier things
like, for instance, America and the world today. You know, we're looked up to, we're respected, we're
listened
to.
I'm sorry, did you say today?
Revered.
Did I?
We're revered.
Did I misspeak? Please correct me, ladies.
Today? Not so much that I'm aware of.
Do tell.
I don't think that the world really kind of looks up to America or sadder. I don't think they depend on America anymore, and I think it's all kind of falling apart and everyone's going their own way because there is no longer any reason not to. There isn't any North Pole anymore.
Mm.
So I can certainly give you examples if anyone is bored. I don't know.
Well, I wanted to see what Miss Scary Smart has to say to that.
Yes.
We've lost our honor. Obama sold our honor for a Nobel Prize, I guess. I don't know. That's really what it comes down to. But we've been losing it for years. You know, we've had so many administrators from both parties who are scared to death to actually do anything with their strength. We're like the 7-foot-tall, gentle giant guy who all the bullies come and pester and pester and pester, and they're scared to flex their muscles and punch because they know as soon as they get into the courtroom, the judge is going to look at them and say, oh, you're guilty. You're so much bigger than him. That's baloney. Quit being scared of it. We don't have a courtroom. We don't have to answer to anyone except ourselves. And I don't think we understand that.
That's a good point. And I think the other part of the equation is that we don't have the moral certainty to do it anymore. Are we really right? Who are we to do this? Not so much that we'll get in trouble in world opinion, but, you know, we're no better than anyone else. America is exceptional the same way Greece is or whatever our president said, you know. So
and
who are we to make this
decision? No, what's going on that we're thinking this of ourselves? We saved the world, literally.
Oh, we've done that repeatedly.
Yeah.
I mean,
if it weren't for America, we would be a world in chaos, real chaos everywhere.
We're starting
in
to
America,
see that now, I think.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But America, for 100 years, has been the pillar of stability, partly because of our geographical location and partly because of who we are. So if we start losing who we are, what's going to happen to the rest of the world? This isn't just about America. This is about everybody.
I agree.
Wow. So America, imagine the world without her.
Mm.
Oh,
exactly.
Wait a minute. Somebody's done that, haven't they?
That sounds familiar.
It does. By the way, has anyone actually seen that movie? It has not been convenient for me to see yet. Has anyone viewed it with their own eyes?
Not yet.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking forward, though.
Yeah, I hope to catch a couple movies next week.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. So America's weaker and the world is suckier. The suckier list is long and growing by the day. We could go back to one of my returning favorites. Of course, you know, the way the majority of the liberal intelligentsia and all right-thinking people support the Palestinians' right to throw bombs at Israel daily for weeks and
with
months
impunity.
And years at a time.
Impunity. I was about to use the same word. They now do it with impunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's just one example. Then, of course, there's, there's the fact that Vladimir Putin, did I say that right? Putin or Putin?
Putin.
Putin.
Oh.
Is,
I don't know.
It's Vladimir KGB.
You know. Yes.
Vlad.
Vlad.
There was the shoot down of amazing loss of an airplane full
coming
of people
on the heels
and
of invasions of the Ukraine. Actually, it's an outshoot of the Ukrainian situation.
Go on.
Mm-hmm.
Just that not long ago, right before Israel started to go into chaos, Russia started to help itself to Ukraine and rebuild the Soviet Empire. And again, why not? There's no net repercussions. No one's going to stop anyone now.
Well, that's true. How much time, when this airliner was pretty clearly shot down and killed almost 300 people, everyone on board, and who knows, maybe some poor bastards on the ground, how much time did our president spend speaking about that? before he raced off to another diplomatic meeting on a golf course?
In all fairness, he gave them a full 40 seconds, from what I understand. So that is significant.
I don't think it was that much. I think
it was upper 30s at least. I know it was upper
30s. It may have been that.
Yeah.
I mean, his time's so valuable.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you want to figure out the per-minute cost that he's wasting when he should be fundraising, yes, it's
mm-hmm.
quite expensive to make those statements. So.
Exactly.
Time is money.
Exactly,
and,
exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. And let's face it, he gave it more time than he did when talking about the bump in the road that was Benghazi.
The bump in the road. Yes,
yeah.
Another thing that people now shoot and kill are ambassadors with impunity, whereas once upon a time that was an act of war. I guess now it's not. So.
Well, yeah, it used to be our embassies and associated places were considered American territory.
It's
an invasion.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Gary Smart, could you get a little closer to your mic? You're a little faint.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that reminds me of one of my favorite stories that nobody knows about, the American hostage crisis in 1979, when the Iranian students took over the American embassy under the saintly leadership of Jimmy Carter, who was much more interested, I think, in being a good Baptist than a good president. So the Iranian students took over the American embassy with the assistance and collusion of the Iranian government. They had, you know, Republican guards all around the place. And by the way, this story is related by Jack Anderson, the late syndicated columnist who broke a lot of interesting stories. So the students, who are having a great time making video propaganda and, you know, torturing and mentally abusing our American hostages, including, you know, embassy staff, they become rather enamored of their power, perhaps the world attention. Hell, they even got some strips in Doonesbury, so you know they had it made in the leftosphere. So they get the bright idea of, we're so powerful, we're so important, we're going to go take over the Russian embassy. And do you know what happened?
No, I hadn't heard this story.
The Republican guards, the Iranian Republican guards, stood in front of the Russian embassy and shot the students.
Wow.
Because they knew Mother Russia would not dither. They knew that Mother Russia would probably turn Tehran into a parking lot.
Wow.
If their embassy was attacked.
Amazing.
It's a true story. Most people don't know it, but I do blame a lot of this kind of nonsense on Jimmy Carter's completely ineffectual response to that incident.
I was just pining for the old Secretary of Defense we had not too long ago, Donald Rumsfeld, who had a real talent for summarizing truths into little sayings and laws, and his great one in 2006, weakness is provocative. Now we're seeing it in spades. We're very weak. Anyone can see it. We're morally weak. We're militarily weak. And our greatest weakness right now is our leadership, of course. And so it's provocative. It's provoking the world to behave badly.
I can see that. I really could, because, you know, you look for leaders to sort of walk the talk. And say what you will about Vlad, he does seem to be, in a lot of ways, what you see is what you get. You see a
mm-hmm.
thug, you get a thug.
Yeah. He's not tried to hide it.
Well, I actually had lunch the other day with another famous person online, Masha, or Masha, however she likes to say it. Maybe you guys have heard of her. She runs a great small government book group on Goodreads. And she herself is actually Ukrainian, and she's of the Russian side of the Ukraine. So I did get her perspective on this a little bit. And she said that actually in Russia right now, Vlad is more popular than he has ever been. And the one thing that she would give him credit for is he loves Russia. And that made me jealous.
Boy, howdy.
Wow.
To
have a leader that loves their country like that, and everyone can get behind them, even if they're a jerk on the world stage.
You know, I wouldn't be too upset if we had a president who was a jerk on the world stage but loved our country and was looking out for us.
I would accept that trade-off. Yep.
In fact, I'm going to tell you, I shouldn't admit this publicly, but my dream presidential candidate will have a couple of campaign slogans. One of them is going to be Let Them Eat Sand.
Oh.
You know, no money to any Middle East country that in any way supports terrorism or jihad. That would be Saudi Arabia. That would be all of them, basically. That would be Egypt. And, if the Islamists want to go back to 600 AD, let them. Complete tech embargo and let them eat sand.
Can we extend Drill that policy here. To socialist countries and communist countries, too?
I haven't found a pithy slogan for that. How about if you want it, you pay for it? I don't know. But I'll start with let them eat sand.
Yep.
Okay. Scary Smart, got anything else to add to this? I know you do.
Well, what's stunning to me about this whole Ukrainian thing is my husband was in Sevastopol earlier this year, and he loved it. He said it was beautiful. The people were beautiful, and then he said the people were beautiful again, which I know what he means by that, but anyway. He said it was just a terrific place. There's no sign of anything on the horizon, and now here we are, just the middle of the year, and we have a passenger plane shot down because of the insurgents there. It's just stunning to me how fast it goes from this wonderful, sunny, touristy place, which is what Sevastopol was. That's in Crimea, if you don't know. To this, you know, it was a matter of a couple of months. And I don't know what to say about it.
That's heartbreaking.
Well, it's more than that. You know, we have to remember that it could happen here. We don't know.
Right.
And we should be always vigilant.
Do you think that, you mean we could be invaded someday? No.
I think we're being invaded someday. Yeah.
I think we are, too. I think that's pretty obvious to more people every day.
Yeah. It's by more than just one group. So.
Yeah, and that racist Rick Perry sending the National Guard down to
How
the Texas
great
border
is he? My God.
To shoot immigrant children.
Yes, that's what I'm sure they're going to do.
Yeah, according to Politico, that's why he's doing it. Couldn't be, you know, there's lawlessness that we actually need some kind of law enforcement, you know, somebody actually enforcing our border, which the president is refusing to do, you know.
How is that? I know they're fixing to sue him and they're putting this together, but by God, it's the president's job to faithfully execute the law, and he just refuses to do it, and he's not doing his job. I just don't. Boy, this takes a long time to fix, I guess. But in the meantime, there is damage done daily.
Yes. Yeah.
For all the things that our forefathers thought to put into the Constitution, I don't think they ever thought that we would have a president who refused to do his job.
Yeah, it's incredible. I've never seen such a thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, you know that some conservative commentators, I think Pat Buchanan was one, they believe that impeaching Barack Obama, which I think Truesberry is going to be doing some strips on that soon, that impeaching Barack Obama would be a terrible thing for the Republicans to do because it would motivate the base, it would turn the black vote completely against the Republicans and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, there is clearly so much dereliction of duty, so much lawlessness. I'm not sure what we can do about that.
I mean, ideally, if the country weren't turned upside down morally these days, then the right thing to do would be to impeach, and the majority of the country would be like, yes, please impeach the lawless president. But I think it's like you say, that people are so demoralized, they are already balkanized into teams. So, yeah, absolutely. It would cause all the problems you're talking about. And, of course, the media being what it is, it would just never, ever be explained properly why it was happening. It would only be racism. That would be the only reason anyone would ever hear. So, yeah, you cannot do it in this environment.
Okay. Well, shucks. That's a little bit of a downer. Let's move on to something a little more upbeat. But first, let's Okay, enough of that. So, in case you're wondering what that was about, many people's childhood, I don't want to use the word raped, but sold into sexual slavery at least.
What are you trying to say?
Really?
You know, beloved icons of our childhood have been hijacked for, shall we say, political purposes. And typically they're going to be progressive political purposes. We've got a gay Green Lantern. The character of Thor, the Marvel Comics character, has been around at least since the 60s. It's suddenly a woman. I haven't got the whole storyline. He may have suddenly realized he was fooling himself for the last 50 years. And wait, there's one more. Archie Andrews, pride of Riverdale High, longtime suitor of Betty the Dominatrix.
Yeah.
No, it was Veronica was the dominatrix,
yeah.
and Betty was the submissive. it turns out in an upcoming comic book, Archie Andrews will die for a good cause.
Several good
Take
causes.
Take it away.
Several, indeed.
They packed a couple into this. The universe of Archie that you're talking about is Life with Archie, which I guess is some sort of spinoff which follows the characters as they become adults. So it is obviously completely humorless and self-important, and the readership reflects that. I believe that they print at this point a little over 2,000 of each issue, and if you know anything about printing and distribution, that's really not a sustainable model. So what sometimes happens in the comic book world is you kill off a character. That's a great way to get a lot of publicity and maybe a little burst of sales. In this case, I think they realized they really need to kill off the character for good, and they wanted to make the most of the opportunity. I'm sorry?
I just said yeah.
Yeah. The publisher and CEO of Archie Comics, John Goldwater, told the Associated Press that they wanted, quote, to do something that was impactful and would resonate with the world. So they tried to pack in a few progressive values here, and Archie does in fact die. He dies taking a bullet for his friend who is gay, who is a military veteran who had post-traumatic stress disorder, and who is, of course, a big gun control advocate as a senator, an elected senator. So they were able to get a few of their favorite things in there.
Oh, don't forget married to his gay partner.
Yes, married as well.
We've got that one too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Correct.
Yeah,
so who was the shooter? Was the shooter perhaps a disgruntled white male member of the Tea Party?
You know what?
Did they miss that?
I got so bored with the whole thing that I did not follow up to who actually did. I think that we can all pretty much guess who the shooter is going to be. I think it's what you just said, because this is so terribly predictable and boring already. So I don't know if you guys read PJ Media every now and then, but they had a funny little poll they were taking there, which basically this was a terrible wasted opportunity, killing off Archie like this. They could certainly have gotten some more of their causes into this untimely death, and they had a poll of other ways that Archie could have met his match. Would you like to hear what they came up with?
Please.
Sure. All right, they gave you four options. The one that came in fourth place was he could have taken a bullet by saving illegal alien activist Jose Antonio Vargas from a Border Patrol agent who was running guns to the drug cartels while also depriving Betty of birth control. That got 10% of the votes.
Okay.
The number three option. Sorry?
Not bad.
Yeah, that's a good one. They get better. The number three choice was saving a gay Palestinian kid from an Israeli soldier who was originally from Texas.
Mm.
11% of the votes.
Okay.
The number two option, he could have died saving an atheist adjunct feminist studies professor who worked at Hobby Lobby from a bullet fired by Ted Cruz.
Mm.
21%.
That's nice. Did they get Chick-fil-A in there?
Sorry?
They didn't have Chick-fil-A in there, though, did they?
You know what? None of these offered a Chick-fil-A option now that you mentioned it.
Oh, my
it.
Gosh. I'm disappointed.
I'm telling you, this is a dreadful missed opportunity. The number one politically correct death that he could have suffered to get the most bang for the buck here, with 58% of the votes, saving a Palestinian Planned Parenthood company officer from an Israeli rocket that was made in Texas and fired by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and Sarah Palin.
Hmm.
Wow.
So, they really could have gone for gold there, but they failed to
do
so.
And once more, we see the lack of creative courage, evidenced by the progressives. I mean, this is one I just recently saw, and what I was struck dumb. This is something that, John F. Kennedy should have put in his book, Profiles in Courage. There's a television series called Scandal, created by Shonda Rhimes, who's also the creator of Grey's Anatomy, another very successful television show.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching the premiere at the recommendation of one of the princesses of White Bread's friends. So the basic conceit is this is a super team of lawyers and smart people who get other people out of trouble. It's almost person of interest without being interesting. The lead character is a very beautiful woman of color. So in the first episode, the person they have to help out of a jam is accused of murder. Well, it in about the first 8 minutes, one character is reading sort of the bio of the accused man. He is a pro-gun. Darling of the conservatives, men should only marry women.
No.
And he is anti-abortion. The character concludes by saying, he's everything I hate, but I will defend him.
That is so noble.
It was. And because that is the one fault liberals have, is they care too damn much. So as we go through the story, it indeed turns out the accused man is innocent, but he is in fact gay.
So he's self-loathing.
So there was a scene where they're saying, we have to put this information out, and he's saying, no, I can't. I'm a decorated military veteran. I represent the uniform. I won't admit I'm gay. And, and I just had to turn off the sound and the picture for a minute to just, luxuriate in the courage of Shonda Rhimes to, to show us a right-wing Christian who is a hypocrite.
That
took
is breathtaking.
That was bravado. That was so daring. I mean, when have we seen that character, especially when you consider that we live in this Christian theocracy, and we have the firing squads, and we have the hand of the right wing controlling the media, and all we see are white people on TV. I mean, this was a profile in courage. And
absolutely.
I actually wiped away a tear as I turned off the television and walked away.
And I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Who is producing War Manure, you or Igor?
I'm sorry, what's that?
Who's producing the most manure here, you or Igor?
Well,
I think that was a
very friend Igor. In fact,
oh my gosh!
He's reaching for the mute button. He's going to mute Scary Smart any moment now.
Smart Igor.
Yeah, but and to go on with another truly missed opportunity and the courage you can't believe. There was a recent episode of True Blood, which is a Southern vampire gothic series. And the episode just this week, I believe, a couple of vampires, for whatever reason, decide to go infiltrate a fictional Ted Cruz rally. So they dress up as they think typical, Republican people would. I think it was Anita Bryant, circa 1960. And the female character apparently said, oh, look, I'm a Republican.
Heard about this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course, right? Yeah, it was. It, I for me, the level of repartee was actually worthy of Noel Coward right there. That that impressed me. Then they also referred to, you know, I had other kind things to say about Republicans, and then they proceeded to go and massacre the people at the rally.
Oh, that must have been so cathartic and delightful. Mm.
Well, what I just thought that was also brave, and of course it was especially brave from the point out that the blood-sucking parasites in the human form were in fact Democrats.
That's an excellent really good summary. Point.
Very
yeah.
Good.
Right. But I thought, wow. In all seriousness, I'm going to lay aside my mockery for a moment. Will you hold this for me, Igor? All mockery aside, just for the moment, we'll return to it. I just wanted to imagine. This is of course all fantasy. I'm just telling the FAA right now, this is all fantasy. There's no way anybody would do this, and it certainly wouldn't be paid for by any of the major networks. But if there was a conservative show, which is the first part of the fantasy, and let's imagine during the run-up to the 2008 elections, they featured the main characters in their story going to an Obama rally and massacring people. Do you think that would have been considered yuck, yuck, great satire?
It would be racist.
It
for
would be,
starters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It would be justification of using government agencies to clamp down on these dangerous fundamentalists.
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah. So let's see. Let me take that back for a minute.
You got it?
He dropped it in my coffee. I had to fish it out. Yeah, so, yes, but anybody else like to talk about the bravery of the current entertainment complexes?
I think we're just surrounded with so many examples of courage that it's difficult to pick one. I'm impressed with the examples you came up with.
What bothers me is that so many conservatives are swimming in so much of this, they don't even see it. They just don't go to the movies. They don't watch TV.
That's
they
me.
Don't read books.
They
yeah.
go to concerts.
Because,
I hate ants.
Yeah. Because there's so much of it, and it's so disgusting, it's easier to just ignore it. And unfortunately, it's indoctrinating everybody around us. The people
yeah.
who do go and who don't realize they're being force-fed this stuff.
As Brett Hume, I think, said when talking about the media, that there, he summed it up, there is a point of view that is so prevalent that it has come to feel like neutrality. So that is the problem
mm-hmm.
in our culture.
Well put. Well, because just to add on to the only reason we watched this show was my wife asked her friend, hey, have you seen any good TV shows we should check out?
Mm-hmm.
And this woman suggested Scandal. And my wife did ask, because we've been burned before.
Yeah.
Sucker
punches.
You know,
yeah.
said, is there any conservative bashing? Because that just gets really old. And her friend, we don't know her affiliations, but we suspect them now. Her friend said, oh, no, it's just a story about how she helps people.
Yep.
Yeah, burned again.
Yeah, ouch.
And this is to Jamie's point, that it's so pervasive that people don't even see it, especially liberals. I mean, they come to accept it as neutrality, and it is the way the world is.
Yeah, it's common knowledge. It's a well-known fact.
Which is why we're all crazy.
Just like it's common knowledge that Sarah Palin is stupid. Which,
exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you know, let's just take a minute to catch our breath while I'm putting the mockery back on. Because remember, whenever things are bad, you may not be able to do a lot, but you can always dance.
Oh. Bar blues.
That's right. Igor was dancing there for us, and that's something nobody really needs to see. So, speaking of culture, popular entertainment media is about telling stories. It is the Prince of Whitebread's personal opinion, validated by no one. that telling stories is how we make sense of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree or disagree, Riot Girls?
I definitely would validate you.
Me too.
Okay, I can hang up now. I feel better. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I don't know what else to say about that, though. I mean, I swim in that. It's obvious to me. I've been in stories my entire life, and that's kind of the core of what I believe in.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
who are we
without our stories?
Just thinking about what you were saying before about the pervasiveness of this point of view in our culture, it is in the stories as well right now. And I know that we three argue that the correction of the stories would maybe change the direction of the culture, but now I'm wondering how much of the culture is reflected in the stories. It's sort of a chicken and egg thing at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
But you only have to change one. You only have to change one, and it will change things.
God willing.
Give us a little more on that, please, Scary Smart.
If you've got a dynamic where you've got one thing resonating off of the other, then all you have to do is take one away or replace it with something else. If we can make enough of an impact on the culture, then we're going to have an impact, or enough of an impact on the story part of the culture, we're going to have an impact on the rest of the culture, the broader culture. It will make a difference. Let's look at Captain America. You know, look at what's happening really with comic book films. You know, we've got obvious heroes, we've got obvious villains. The ones that fail are the ones that don't set that up in black and white, and that's because the culture wants it. But when you put them out there, not only do they get more popular, they're out there for young guys who have not been exposed to the black and white. They've only seen the sociology stuff, and you know, the everything's in shades of gray.
Mm-hmm.
So their internal knowledge of the fact that there is, their internal knowledge of the fact that there is a concrete good and a concrete evil is reinforced when they go and they see Captain America,
right,
or they go and they see The Dark Knight. That's going to resonate back. If one of those guys writes a story later that uses the same concept, it's going to come back into the culture again. That's what we want. We want to set up a resonation that will offset what's already out there, something that will get rid of the mushy grays that our current culture seems to have as the prevalent story.
Mm. Okay. The moral confusion.
You just gave me another campaign slogan, ladies.
Oh, no. What is it?
Change your story, change your life.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Because
yeah.
What is a story a lot of, kids in the hood are told?
Oh, terrible stories.
The man is keeping me down. It's all out of my control.
Yes,
I have a helpless pawn, and I might as well just take the crumbs the man gives me.
Yep.
Well, or the only way to take charge is to be a thug, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right.
In whatever area you want to be a thug, that's the only way to take charge. And it results in a very unhealthy culture. You're exactly right.
Yeah,
but if we can get more positive role models into that, then we can change all those young boys' lives and give them something better to look for and something better to work for. Sure.
Yes, it's just Herculean. It's just Herculean.
Of course it is.
And the one or two who start trying to change the story get torn down so quick by the others. You worry for their safety.
Well, what happened during the Civil Rights Movement? They weren't. You had a lot of people who were in a lot of pain for a long time, but they kept going, and they eventually got what they were looking for. Now, there were other things that entered that weren't good.
Right.
But
got hijacked pretty quick, that one.
Yeah, it did, unfortunately. But we can't let that happen. Obviously, it's not going to happen with this one because it's a completely different paradigm.
Right.
But sometimes you've got to be willing to take the risks. And sometimes you've got to be willing to be the general and take the risks with other people. And that sucks. That sucks worse than taking it yourself.
Yeah, the burden of command.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel that every day on the show.
I'm sure.
Well, going back to this idea of, and I'm just so proud of it, I may just rest on this for the rest of the year, change your story, change your life. There's been a little, some dissension, not only from liberals, but conservatives as well, because our friends over at Liberty Island are putting their thumb in some people's eyes. I think Scary Smart has a few thoughts on that. And Scary, can you make sure you're close to your microphone? You're still a little faint.
Oh, I'm trying here. It's, I think
there
it might
go.
Just be the microphone.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let's see. It's right up against my face now. Let's see. What I was talking about with you the other day was Rod Dreher in The American Conservative. Let me see what's the title here. Tea Party Literature? He questions. First of all, it's not Tea Party literature.
Yeah.
I don't know why he wants to call it Tea Party literature, except for what I figured out about the third time I read through this article. He is writing this in response to Adam Bello's National Review piece, which everyone should read. If you haven't read it already, you need to read it, because it is basically a manifesto talking about what the conservative arts movement needs to be. And how conservatives and libertarians can do it together. So,
to interrupt you, I'm sorry, Scary. I just noticed when I was reading the article myself, just like you did, the title alone struck me. I had this vision of the author sitting in a book-lined study with leather patches on his elbow and a pipe in his mouth, saying literature and sort of Tea Party literature, a little curl of the lip, as if
all the humanity and all the positive
spirit. It was just.
Do you read Dreher regularly? Because he really does sound like that most of the time. I like him, don't get me wrong, because he's got a lot of intelligent things to say, but he really does come across as the leather elbow patch guy.
Mm.
I don't think I'd read him before you exposed me to him, so maybe I'll look for him in the future. But do go on. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just had to get that in.
That's fine. Yeah. So anyway, supposedly this is an answer to Adam Bello's manifesto. But what it really is he read this other guy, Adam Kirsch's article about Adam Bello's manifesto in the Jewish magazine, The Tablet. Adam Kirsch didn't get at all what Adam Kirsch didn't at all understand what Adam Bello was trying to do.
This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But he didn't get Adam Bello. And he doesn't like what Adam Bello is doing anyway. So, of course, his article was hostile. So what Dreher did, and I have no idea why he did this, is instead of going out and reading Liberty Island, and reading some of the articles that some of the books that Adam Bello suggested to read in his BuzzFeed essay, which had, 22 books? Really? 22 for the most part. 21?
Mm-hmm.
Close enough.
Yeah.
But instead of doing that, he goes and he takes stuff that Adam Kirsch said about Adam Bello and rehashes it as his own. And he totally doesn't get it. Hold on. Let's see, I've got to find things again on my own computer that I just made notes of.
I printed out
and highlighted. Well, I did. I have everything highlighted, too, but it would take me forever to take this out.
Yeah.
He, for some reason, well, actually, I know what reason now. Dreher thinks Adam Bello is angry. He thinks that this is a movement out of anger. Do you guys feel angry?
I can't deny that there is some of that. I'm tired of being insulted and belittled and vilified.
I am, too. But are you, like raging against the machine here, or are you just like...
No, I'm not a crazy progressive. I'm a normal person with a point of view.
Exactly. Yeah. We're tired. What I said here is we're tired of being ignored and passed over. We're tired of the assumption that conservatives aren't creative. We're tired of being called racist and sexist because we tell the truth.
Correct.
And so we're finally talking.
Yeah.
So Dreher thinks that because we're talking and we're saying, look, this is not acceptable, he thinks we're angry. But actually... He's not the one who thinks we're angry. He's getting it from this other stupid essay.
I'm surprised.
I don't know why he did that.
Which side is he on?
I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed because Dreher is usually very, very good about these things, and this time he wasn't. So, I think he phoned it in on this one. It's 3,000 words of phoning it in, but still.
Well, don't phone it in when someone's trying to build a new company. It matters.
He's been called on it, but that's behind the scenes. I know stuff. Anyway, even if we were mad, who cares? You know, we're not Jedi. We're not supposed to be these emotionless machines. We're supposed to be angry sometimes. It's healthy to be angry at things that are wrong, that are unfair.
Correct.
And it's sometimes an excellent tool for getting things done.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what we're doing with it. We're turning that anger, that unhappiness with the way things are. Yeah, that's the right grammar.
Mm-hmm.
Into the passion to change things and
correct.
The energy to change things. You know, when I get mad at this stuff, I try to channel it back down into let's do something about it now.
Yeah.
And I think most of us do. And that's the same thing Adam Bello is doing. Yeah, he's had problems for since the 1970s trying to get his voice out there. He channeled it into getting the nonfiction stuff out there.
Yeah, and doing
and now
very well.
he did extremely well.
Yeah.
And now that that's kind of on coast and it's being, you know, subverted by people who shouldn't be subverting it.
Mm-hmm.
We won't mention any names here.
Mm-hmm.
But now that that's happened, he's trying to do the same thing with where is there anger there? Where is there some negativity in there?
This is actually what's positive. That's what conservatives do. They build up.
Yes, they create. They don't destroy.
Correct.
That's the point exactly. There's two types of anger. There's the destructive.
Correct.
The Anakin Skywalker type of anger. And then there's the creative, the building anger.
Mm-hmm.
Where you say, you know what, this isn't fair. Let's fix this and make something that is fair.
Yeah. What can we do better? Definitely. Maybe they have a point. Maybe we aren't getting our stuff out there enough.
Yeah. And that's all we're trying to do. We're just trying to get our voices out there.
Well, what's interesting is it just reminded me when you said he's saying we're angry, and that sounds almost like exactly what the left said about the Tea Party. In fact, they repeated that line several times. The original article in the Jewish periodical was, you know, that the Tea Party is this festering mass of male white resentment that hates illegals and so on and so on. And, you know, that alone made me think, well, I'm going to doubt the rest of these guys' suppositions because he doesn't know a damn thing about the Tea Party. But that's the immediate presumption of people who are challenging our alleged betters is, you know, we're angry.
Yeah.
Just to me, it's just interesting to note that he said we're angry without much, I don't know, evidence?
Support? Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's several funny things in my book, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But you said something else interesting, Jamie. So Scary Smart, you said we're going to, you know, we take that anger, we channel it, we try to do something with it. What can, you know, Fernando and Daryl and Charles and the guys over at the NSA, if they're angry, what could they do to change the GOP right now, which was the what one of y'all called it something like the gutless ordinary party or something like that, under the leadership of the eunuch John Boehner, and I believe Scary Smart was going to give us a few tips for the average Joe, the you, the me, the prince of white bread, even what we could do today, what small step we could take to make some changes, to have the GOP, to have a political party actually reflect our beliefs and our priorities. Take it away, Scary Smart.
Well, I'm going to expand on this, obviously, but I think the number one thing is to just make it fun to be conservative. Everybody thinks that we're these buttoned-up, pursed lips, tight-kneed, anal people. You know, these almost machine-like people who are only interested in money and controlling everybody else's sex lives. I don't care about either one.
So what you're saying would explain why the Mazzola parties I tried to have with the local Republican Party didn't work?
It might, but no.
Okay.
But seriously, make it fun to be conservative. There's no reason it can't be fun. And I can't give you a whole lot of different ways to do that, but I can give you a few. You know, you can do lunch with your friends and talk about politics during lunch. Don't make politics a taboo subject anymore. Mm-hmm. Learn how to talk to your friends about politics, even if they don't agree with you, and learn how to communicate with each other in a peaceful manner. If we're talking about politics by saying religion and politics are off limits, we we have deprived ourselves of the opportunity to rationally debate these things.
So if something has to go, it's going to be our manners first. Their manners went a long time ago on the other side.
Well, yeah, but that's beside the point. But, you know, it's mannerly to not discuss these things just because you want the hostess's party to go okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if you set up a lunch or a party and you explicitly say, we're going to talk about all the stuff that we're not supposed to talk about,
huh.
You know, that's going to be different. That's going to be fun. And you'll probably find out a whole lot about your friends. You know,
nobody cares about my hair plugs.
I do.
Okay.
But we'll talk about that later.
Thank you.
This is not the time or the place, Prince.
No, it's really not. And really, nasal hairs? Why? I don't know.
We're going to do a whole show on that.
But anyway, the other thing that I want to really encourage is just to not be afraid of saying, hey, I'm a conservative. We've all been backed into this little corner, this little closet in some people's cases, where we've been terrorized into not saying who and what we are. Now, it's a little bit easier for me because I'm down in the South and you guys aren't.
Yeah.
But
I'm in my closet, as you know.
I know. We know. No. But... But if you stop being scared of it, if you just go on and you put it out there, even when you're in a group of folks that you're sure are liberals, you say, hey, I'm a conservative, then you'd be surprised how many people walk up to you, kind of sidestep and say, you know what, I am too, but I'm afraid to talk about it.
That
it's
happened
amazing.
To me in my last job, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah, because I was out at that job, and people would always come up to me in private, always. I think
weird.
It's wrong too. This is horrible. I don't know what to do. But they were afraid, you know.
Why
but it's
are
very
they so
it's,
afraid?
It's very moralizing for those people. If you are willing to put yourself out there and take the hit, mm-hmm. it's helpful to other people so they don't feel so alone in the world.
Yes, yes, and it gives you something to talk about. You make new friends that way.
Yep.
You find interests you didn't even know each other had.
Yep.
And it just makes a difference.
Yeah.
But once you've made it fun and once you've come out and you've started to draw people to you, then you can start going through the steps to get people to get out there and vote. You know, you go vote, you bring your friends to the voting poll with you, you go do lunch after you vote, you bring your family and you do a family thing after you vote. It doesn't matter what you do, just get a bunch of people to go and vote and have fun doing it. So,
okay.
You know, those are some things that you can start with.
I have to say that a lot of my friends who tend to vote left have brought stuff up in conversation because they are starting to be disillusioned and concerned with the direction of the country, and it's a wonderful opening. And when that happens, I do take the opening and I say, well, you know, this and that. So, and I'm encouraged to see so many people questioning this dogma.
It's almost like evangelizing, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a coincidence, but that's just me.
No, I don't think it's a coincidence at all.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of religion wrapped up in our politics these days, even for people who are atheists.
Well, one of the biggest wars right now is to shut down freedom of religion, which is the basis for a lot of what's going on culturally.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the first thing the communists did?
Absolutely.
Religion.
And how well does that ever work out in those societies?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about working out for. Works out just fine for the people at the top.
I guess so, until the other wave takes over and shoots them. And then, yeah.
Well, they don't think about that part. They only think about today.
Like those couple of glorious years that they will have.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And then
so,
hope they can escape with the money.
Yeah. Those tips and others will soon be posted up on the Right Wing Riot website.
Ooh, I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be live soon. We're hoping to have it live by the next show with some interesting graphics. We'll have possibly a piece by the Prince of White Bread on the liberal way. Tips from Scary Smart, and maybe we could get a little something from Ms. Always Right.
Well, I didn't know everyone else was going to write stuff. Maybe I will, too.
Did I let that slip?
Can we have a picture of Igor?
I will see if I can find a picture of Igor. I did have some video of him playing his favorite kind of music.
Oh, no.
There he is, right now.
Okay.
I can't make the man stop. Tygor, down, down, boy. There we go. Okay.
Was he on
apparently
the table
Boogie
again?
Woogie. Boogie Woogie is God's music. That's been proven pretty conclusively. Let's see. Anything else to anybody we need to plug very quickly here? We're down to about the last four exciting minutes of the show.
No, I plan to go and hopefully see the film Persecuted this week, which I think I've plugged before, but I don't know if it's that great yet. It looks pretty good to me. It's got some great talent in it, and I'm excited to see the good guy being a Christian for once.
Wow. That guy will never be on Scandal. We know that for sure. Liberty Island, our friends over at Liberty Island, God love them. They have concluded their first crowdfunding drive. They made over $15,000 towards
Woo!
Their future and some of their future projects. You can still support their – they started a new drive to support a couple of novels that they're going to put out in the fall.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, are they really?
I heard about those.
Yeah, anything good coming up, you think?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of good books in there.
I've heard.
I've only read one of them, so I can't say. But we'll talk more about that next week, I imagine.
I can't wait till you can talk about it.
Yeah. Well, also, next week we're going to start a new feature on the show. It's going to be the Big Book of Comforting Fairy Tales for Delicate Liberals. I think that will be a great kindness to our liberal friends who are so anxious pretty much about everything.
That's a nice service.
I think so too.
I'm just a giver. What can I say?
Yeah.
also, it's possible, we're still researching it, but it's possible we'll have the Minority Report, which will be the stirring story of Liz Warren's journey from the Res to the Senate. Again, this is for our liberal friends so that they can be equipped with the facts.
By the
Res,
you mean Harvard University, correct?
It's a lot tougher place than people think.
Oh, I see.
I mean, the sexism, the racism, the microaggressions, you know, it's...
and it's very rapey, too.
It's, you know, it is the hell that she came from.
Poor woman. What a compelling life story.
In fact, I think I'm going to light a candle for Liz Warren after the show is over.
Oh, you're a good man.
You don't know me well. So this is pretty much our show for the week. Any last words? We have 2 minutes. Scary, smart.
Just if you start talking about Liz Warren, you can look forward to some rants from me.
Oh. Do tell. Next week.
Yes.
And you, Ms. Always Right?
Oh, I've got nothing. I got nothing.
Okay. I will say, look up Tacky Mag. That's T-A-K-I magazine. They have some interesting articles. They do have one on Liberty Island, which warms some of our hearts, at least mine.
That's a good magazine overall. That was a good find. I don't remember which one of you came up with that. That's a good find.
Yeah, it was pretty enjoyable and very snarky.
Good stuff.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
They're very snarky. That's
it for us. So thank you, Riot Girls. And
thank you,
we'll
Prince.
Be back next week.
All right.
We're out of time for today's Riot. You can find us on the web at rightwingriot.com. No hyphen, all one word, Right Wing Riot. Thanks to our generous internet radio host, Daria Ann DiGiovanni.